be frightened, shields high, ready for these horsemen to attack. They edged back slowly towards the trees. "Hold!" Blackstone called, to keep back his own men, as well as to stop the Frenchmen. "We serve the English king, and enforce the truce. We take the allegiance of the ceded towns. I am Sir Thomas Blackstone." At the mention of his name, the French soldiers spoke hurriedly among themselves and retreated faster. "Sir Thomas," Moulin called, asking whether the men should attack. "No," Blackstone ordered. The French were now well into the trees, where they formed a line, shields high. They were not running. They were waiting.
"Sir Thomas, they see us as their enemy. They are too few to attack us, but there'll be horsemen somewhere," said John Jacob.
Blackstone's men restrained their horses, who had picked up their riders' uncertainty. And then the bastard horse yanked its head so hard that the reins were nearly pulled through Blackstone's grip. It turned away from the trees and faced the empty stretch of meadow. Several hundred yard-long paces away, the breeze ruffled the treetops. The grass wavered. The bastard horse snorted, muscles quivering. It raised its ugly, misshapen head, and with ears erect pawed the ground.
"Be ready!" Blackstone called.
There was no sign of any movement, no sound of hoofbeats, but Blackstone trusted the horse's instincts even more than his own.
"Moulin, watch those men in the trees."
And then they felt the tremor rumbling through the ground.
"Will, get your archers back."
There would be no time for the lightly armed archers to defend themselves if they were caught between an approaching attack and the men in the forest. Will Longdon's men spurred their horses away. The veteran archer glanced over his shoulder as the horizon blurred and a smudged line of colour rose like a winter sunrise. Surcoats of blue, gold and red, crimson and black banners and fish-tailed pennons. Heavy horses thundering towards Blackstone, men with shields raised and sword and mace ready to strike. It was impossible to gauge how many charged across the meadow, but it was a great many more than the few Blackstone commanded. Longdon covered 300 yards and then leapt from his horse. His archers did the same, abandoning their mounts to run free. He watched as Moulin wheeled left into the tree line with a dozen or more men, and Blackstone led the charge into the approaching horsemen with Kilbert and the others. Once the men clashed, horses would surge through the English ranks. Longdon's bow was already clear of its waxed linen bag, the heart of yew bent, its cords strung on its horn tips. All was done with rapid, practiced ease, as his eyes stayed on the approaching horsemen, and now he saw that they outnumbered Blackstone 3-1, at least. There was a gentle hump in the meadow behind Blackstone as his men galloped forward. The ground had been pushed up. Perhaps a long-disappeared tree stump had been there. It made no difference whether it was an unmarked grave, rotted tree, or creatures from the underworld clawing their way from hell. It was a marker.
180 paces, he cried, as the bowmen lined up each side of him. Rising ground. Seen?
The archers quickly found it and called their acknowledgement. They pushed a handful of arrows into the ground at their feet, knocked the first, and waited. The Frenchmen-at-arms had been returning to the foot soldiers' position when they saw the armed horsemen, who looked no different than the routiers they were hunting. Given the distance between them, they spurred their horses into a canter and then a gallop, whose impact would smash the lightly armoured men. What the French could not see through their visors as they advanced, sweat already stinging their eyes, breath sucked in through the heat of their helms, were the archers who had retreated behind the line of approaching horsemen. Men who rode tightly together, urging their horses into a canter, and then suddenly splitting to veer left and right, leaving a half-dozen men in the centre. The urge to kill surged through the Frenchmen. These routiers had no discipline, and if some had already peeled away to escape, then they would be hunted down at leisure. The bastard horses' lumbering gait barged between two horses, forcing them to swerve. The man-at-arms to Blackstone's right could not swing his sword from that angle, but the one on Blackstone's shield arm twisted in the saddle and struck. Blackstone took the blow on his shield as he rammed Wolfe's sword into the other man's unprotected side. No sooner had they clashed than the Frenchman's speed carried them through. Kilbert and John Jacob, who were half a length behind Blackstone, thundered into the enemy. Blackstone heard screams and the thud of bodies hitting the ground. Horses were whinnying, and cries of alarm rose up from the Frenchmen, who had lost control of their galloping mounts. Blackstone's men had ridden and struck at the canter, and their slower pace made it easier to wheel their horses around to see their attackers in disarray. The Frenchmen, who managed to steady their mounts, leaning back in their saddles, yanking their horses' bits, tearing at their mouths, were once again bearing down on the Englishmen. But the English, who the French thought had broken and run, had now turned onto the Frenchmen's flanks, effectively encircling them. Other French men-at-arms had galloped on towards the line of men who stood, backs arched, faces skyward. The Frenchmen's laboured breathing and curses trapped inside their helms stopped them from hearing what sounded like the wind ravaging the forest, creaking the trees' boughs, and releasing a sudden whispering gust. They were 20 horse strides from the underworld's creatures' attempt to claw them down into their lair, and by the time they reached the archer's marker, the arrows had stung man and beast. Moulin had barged into the trees with his men, their mounts trampling the foot soldiers, but the confines of the forest made manoeuvring the horses too difficult. His men quickly dismounted and fought those who had not turned and run. The Norman used his shield like a battering ram, and Renfred's and Tate's men hacked and cut their way into the crumbling French line. It was grunting, sweating work despite the cold, but the men's blood was up, and the horses had already done damage to many of the foot soldiers. Moulin's men, working in twos and threes, chased the scattered French, overpowering equally those who stayed to fight, alone or in pairs, and those who ran and foundered in the undergrowth, and whose fear tormented their last moments of life. Those who turned and begged for mercy were also killed. The archers could not loose more arrows because of the proximity of Blackstone's men, so they dropped their bows and ran to dispatch the wounded French with knife and sword. No mercy was granted, except for a quick death. Four of Blackstone's men lay dead on the grass, but the French were routed. One knight had seen the futility of their attempt to break through these vicious fighters and signalled a retreat. He and a handful of survivors galloped to escape, and Blackstone watched as, once clear, he reined in his horse and turned to look at Blackstone's men. He must have called out to his three companions, as they too forced their horses to slow and then turn. The knight wore good armour, and his distinctive yellow shield bore the image of a stag's head. He waited, midfield. His horse's lungs heaved, but its rider sat upright, sword at his side, facing Blackstone. The three knights who accompanied him drew alongside. Blackstone saw the knight raise his visor and say something to the others, who then held back their horses as he urged his own forward. He stopped 80 yards from Blackstone and waited again, sword lowered.
"Hold your ground,"
Blackstone called, raising Wolf's sword and signalling his men to halt any further attack. He pushed the bastard horse into a trot and drew up 10 paces from the stag's head knight.
"I am Sir Godfrey de Albinet. You have committed a slaughter here today on great and good men who serve their king."
"It's not the first time I have thinned out your king's ranks," said Blackstone.
The knight frowned, and then he looked more intently at the worn and battle-scarred shield on Blackstone's arm. The blazon showed a mailed fist, grasping a sword blade like a cross. The words, "Défaillant à la mort," were etched in black lettering.
"Blackstone," Sir Godfrey muttered.
"Sir Godfrey, I do not wish this conflict. You brought it on yourself. I serve the English king, who takes only what is rightfully his."
The French knight became agitated.
"You are a brigand, and wanted for atrocities on women and children. You have raped and murdered. You are no different than the routiers we seek to destroy."
He looked around at the corpses of his men strewn across the field. Archers were going among the dead, stripping what wealth could be found as they tugged free their arrows.
"Had I seen your archers?"
He let the words trail off in regret.
"What? You wouldn't have attacked?
I would have returned with more men and taken you on your flanks."
"The result would have been the same. And you are wrong about me and my men. You have been lied to."
"Our king does not lie. He has issued a warrant."
"Your king wants me dead. So too the Dauphin."
"For your crimes."
"For my success. Rumour and lies serve their desire to have me dead. and for noblemen like you to die trying to kill me. Surrender, and you will live. I will accept your word that you will not fight, and I will release you on parole."
Sir Godfrey spat a globule of phlegm into the ground towards Blackstone.
"Surrender to a murderer."
"To an English knight," said Blackstone. "You and your three companions. I will not ask you to remain silent about where you saw me, but I will hold you to your word and accept your parole."
For a moment it seemed the Frenchman might agree. A look of acceptance crossed his face, but then he shook his head, as if listening to his own voice of reason.
"I cannot," he said. "There is no honour surrendering to you.
Is there more honour being killed by me?"
"You would have your archers slay us?"
"I would kill you myself."
"Don't die needlessly, Sir Godfrey. You are confident that you can defeat me?"
"But if it is I who defeat you, you will either be dead or my prisoner.
What chance would I have against your men?"
"You would be free to go.
My word is my honour."
Sir Godfrey glanced over his shoulder.
"My companions will fight with me. Choose your men."
And with that final abrupt demand, he wheeled his horse around and returned to his companions. Blackstone rode back to Kilbert and told him of the French knight's decision.
"I wish these bastards would know when they are beaten.
Their arrogance chafes," said Kilbert, as he drank wine thirstily from a flask.
"All right. Who fights with us?"
"John Jacob and Renfred."
"Aye, they'll finish these noblemen off in good time, and they'll have belts of silver and daggers encrusted with precious stones. Decent plunder. I found only a few rings on those I killed, but I gave them to Will Longdon's lads. They took good care of those horsemen."
He sighed, corked the flask, and gathered the reins.
"But the archers are going to need more arrows if we ride into any more of these French."
"We could steal a few barrels of arrows from Chandos and Feltham, if we could find them, but I dare say they are warming their asses somewhere in a nobleman's great hall and bedding his servant girls.
Right, let's get on with it. I'll need food in my belly before it gets dark. Fighting always gives me an appetite."
Blackstone called to Renfred, who had fought with Moulin in the trees. The German caught his horse, which had wandered a few feet from the killing, and led it to where Blackstone, Kilbert, and John Jacob waited.
"Sir Gilbert and I will take the centre. John, you and Renfred draw the other two away. I suspect they will want me dead quickly, so they'll strike at me first. If you attack the man on the right flank, his sword arm will be hampered by his position until he breaks and turns. This isn't a tourney. The two of you go at him, kill him, and then attack the fourth man."
"Wait," said Kilbert, and pointed across the field. The knight's three companions had suddenly spurred their horses in an attempt to escape through the far group of Blackstone's men who had encircled them. They rode tightly together, knee to knee, which made it impossible for Blackstone's men to stop all of them. One at least would be sacrificed, perhaps two, but it was certain that one would escape. Perhaps Sir Godfrey had not taken Blackstone's word and thought the archers would kill him. Whatever his reasoning, it seemed he was prepared to fight alone, in an attempt to allow others to get away and warn the French about Blackstone. They watched as the French men-at-arms broke free and hit Blackstone's stationary line of horsemen. The impact carried two of them through, as the third was hemmed in and killed. Half a dozen of Blackstone's men gave chase. The French knight, too, watched his men's bold attempt and then turned his horse to face Blackstone.
"I'll take him," said Kilbert, and was about to spur his horse. But Blackstone blocked him.
"No. He made his choice. It's me he wants."
Sir Godfrey dropped his visor, raised his shield, and then dug heels into his horse's flanks. The war horse's hooves tore up the ground, sending up clods of turf. It was obvious the French knight was an experienced fighter. Blackstone just managed to hold back the bastard horse, who fought the bit and then lowered his great head, until his rider eased the reins slightly and the muscled beast unleashed its strength. Blackstone cursed as its uneven gait unbalanced him. His open-faced helm made him more vulnerable, should the French knight find a way to jab at his eyes or slash his face. He tucked his chin onto his chest, raised the shield to just below his eyes, and steered the pounding horse with his knees and heels. Sir Godfrey was swirling a spiked flail, the length of its chain, meaning he would be able to strike before Blackstone could deliver a sword blow.
Damn it. Stay straight. Straight, for Christ's sake.
He swore silently as the wayward beast beneath him took it upon itself to suddenly veer. It was an uncontrolled movement that saved Blackstone's life. The Frenchman had altered his strike. No longer was the flail swirling around his arm in a sweeping arc. The knight's skill had allowed him to bring it down, rather than across Blackstone's body. It would have torn the shield and half his face away had the bastard horse not changed direction moments before the two men collided. The length of chain wrapped around Blackstone's sword arm, and the spiked ball bit into his mail. The speed of the two horses meant that the Frenchman galloped past Blackstone, and his strength pulled Blackstone from the saddle. Blackstone tumbled in the air and landed face down. The effort tore the flail from Sir Godfrey's grip, and he heaved on his horse's reins and drew his sword as Blackstone thumped into the ground. The impact had torn Blackstone's helm away, and as he groggily raised his head, spitting dirt and grass, he saw Kilbert in the distance place a restraining arm on John Jacob. This was Blackstone's fight. He clambered to his feet and shook free the shield from his arm. With Wolf's sword in his right hand and the retrieved flail in his left, he braced himself as the Frenchman charged him down. The knight bent down from the saddle, bringing back his sword arm in a sweeping blow that would be hard to deflect. As the wide-eyed horse was almost upon him, so close that he saw its blood-flecked nostrils and smelt its breath, Blackstone sidestepped, swung the spiked chain, and caught the horse's leading leg. He did not have the strength to haul the horse to the ground, but as he bent his back and dug in his heels, the horse's leg was snagged for a vital stride, and that made the beast falter. The flail's hand slipped through his hands, but the stumbling horse had thrown the unbalanced Frenchman. As the horse danced away, kicking free the entangled chain, Blackstone strode towards the man who had determined to kill him and gain favour from his king. He got to his feet, dazed, and pushed up his visor, turning on his heel, looking for the Englishman. As he spun, he saw Blackstone. Eyes wide with surprise, he raised his sword. Too late. Wolf's sword's honed steel blade rammed into his face, through his skull, up into his brain. He fell back, arms wide. His body shuddered and was then still. Blackstone reached down and pulled free the inlaid silver sword belt and scabbard from the fallen nobleman. Dead men's plunder was his bounty. Blackstone and the French were once again at war. Chapter 61 La Roche was not a town, but an area made up of craggy rocks and, in places, dense woodland. The hillsides rose and fell, their boulder-strewn forests making travel arduous. Blackstone and his men travelled for days through the remote hamlets. Many were little more than a handful of wattle and mud hovels next to a muddy track, rutted deeply from handcarts. Where the ground had become impassable, the locals had laid cut ferns and branches to accommodate their donkeys' passage. Most had no livestock other than a pig or a milk-giving goat. Blackstone questioned these forest dwellers, who knew the woodland as well as any wild creature, but none had seen or heard of brigands led by a grey-bearded man who wore silver armbands and silver and gold rings on his fingers. Ancient foresters' tracks were often overgrown, but Blackstone's scouts found a route wide enough to support oxen dragging felled timbers to some charcoal makers in their crude woodland hamlet. These people had no wealth for routiers to plunder, so their safety was guaranteed. A nearby monastic cell supported a few monks, who had struck out years before to bring God's grace to these peasants. The monks themselves were as filthy and unkempt as those they tried to help, and they had learnt the bitter lesson that trying to survive by growing crops in the unyielding ground kept them in a state of near starvation and dependency on those to whom they had come to offer spiritual succour. The woodcutters and charcoal burners trapped and shared what little food they had with the monks. It seemed a small price to pay for salvation. "It's time we stopped," said Kilbert. "We've been chasing the bastard for too long. This ground will exhaust the horses. will suffer injury at this rate, Thomas. Blackstone nodded. The small clearing they had entered offered new-growth saplings and overgrown ferns and bramble. There was no sign of boar or other animal tracks, and the last woodcutter's hamlet was less than a mile behind them. It was unlikely that wolves would venture this close to a settlement. He turned to his squire.
"John, we encircle the clearing. Separate the horses, no more than 10 hobbled at a time. If we are attacked, we will only lose some of them. Have Will and Jack hunt us some fresh meat. Sir Gilbert and I will camp below those boulders."
He glanced up at the rustling branches and gauged the wind direction.
"Latrines to be dug down there, beyond those rocks."
John Jacob needed no further instruction and turned his horse to relay Blackstone's commands to the captains. Will Longdon and Jack Halfpenny brought down 4 deer, one of which, when gutted and skinned, Blackstone sent back to the nearby woodcutters. They could only snare small game for their pots, so to have an English bowman bring down big game was cause for celebration. Their fires burned brightly, and even though Blackstone's men were deep in the forest, the rising ground where they camped showed them the village's flickering light in the distance. Blackstone's generosity was repaid next morning, when a scurvy-looking wretch made his way into the camp.
"Sir Thomas,"
said Moulin, as he led the peasant woodcutter up the path to where Blackstone and Kilbert were washing in the stream that tumbled down the rocks. Blackstone pulled his head from the water and dragged his fingers through his hair. The tall Norman pointed behind himself, past the woodcutter. A monk, his tonsure unshaven for days, his face stubbled with ingrained dirt. Smoke smudges encrusted on his wrinkled skin, was panting towards him. John Jacob had stopped him 20 yards downhill, waiting for Blackstone's command to allow the monk closer.
"Said he had to speak to you and you alone. I searched him. He has no weapon," Jacob called.
"My lord," said the woodcutter, as he knelt respectfully in the dirt, "this monk bade me bring him to you. I am blessed by him, if you will see him."
"Get up," said Blackstone. "No need to kneel before me."
The woodcutter rose as Blackstone beckoned the monk forward. Sweat streaked the man's face despite the chill air.
"My lord," said the monk, bowing slightly.
"You promise this man a blessing?" said Blackstone.
The monk looked nonplussed. Kilbert wiped a cloth across his chest to dry off the stream water.
"A blessing. A promise of heavenly gratitude. A touch of your grubby hand on his lice-infested head."
"I have a message for Sir Thomas Blackstone," said the monk, paying no attention to Kilbert's chiding.
"Monk, you had better not ignore this knight," said Blackstone, "or he will baptize you again in this icy stream."
The monk, surprised, glanced at the half-naked Kilbert, who did not appear to be anything more than a pock-faced hobbler. Then he clasped his hands together, bowed his head, and muttered an abject apology.
"Give the man his blessing, then," said Kilbert.
The peasant woodcutter, rank with stale sweat and wood smoke, grasped the monk's equally grubby hand and kissed it. The monk winced. Even though his own stench was no different to that of the man whose spittle wet the back of his hand. He fought the urge to step away, but the two half-naked men in front of him scowled with annoyance. He made the sign of the cross, muttered a benediction, and when the peasant pulled off his cap, the monk placed his hand on the matted hair and finished his blessing. The toothless woodcutter's gums grinned at Blackstone.
"My lord, me and mine are here to serve you."
He bowed again, and then returned the way he had come.
"What do you want?" Blackstone asked the monk.
"I have a message for Sir Thomas Blackstone," repeated the monk, looking uncertainly from Blackstone to Kilbert, who raised a hand and pointed at Blackstone.
The monk began his message again.
"I have... Merciful God in heaven!"
"No wonder you have been cast into this wilderness," said Kilbert. "You must have bored your abbot to death. Give us the damned message." The monk fumbled in the small leather purse on the rope around his waist, and teased out a leather cord bearing a small silver medallion He reached forward, offering it to Blackstone. It was the same silver-wheeled goddess that he wore around his neck.
He says he will meet you at the Roman aqueduct, but that you are to come alone.
Chapter 62 The ancient aqueduct spanned a narrow valley. On Blackstone's side of the vale, five of the arches soared up above the tree line. He looked across the open ground, which gave him a clear view of the level ground behind him, and a similar view of the landscape opposite. If there were an ambush, it would be from archers concealed on the lower slopes in the tree line. Kilbert had cursed and threatened to send Will Longdon and a dozen archers to protect him, but Blackstone had insisted he honour Ap Madoc's demand, and forbade anyone from following him. The monk had made his way beneath one of the arches, and called out that Thomas Blackstone had arrived. His voice echoed along the curved stonework, then carried across the expanse of the valley. Blackstone watched the trees on the opposite side for any movement. There were no archers riding with Griffith Ap Madoc when last he saw him, but it was not impossible that he had gathered English bowmen to him in the time that had passed. The movement, when he saw it, did not come from the opposite side, but from further down the open ground, beyond the arches, on Blackstone's side. A lone horseman, a man who seemed too big for his own sturdy mount, eased into view and halted. The startled monk turned quickly.
"Sir Thomas, that's him.
I know who it is. Get back to your work and prayers, brother monk."
The unkempt cleric needed no further urging and strode away quickly, and as he disappeared back into the forest beyond the clearing, Griffith Ap Madoc rode forward at a leisurely pace. Blackstone watched him. There was no sign of the Welshman glancing left or right, no sense of him being wary or of readying himself to give a signal to any hidden men. As he reached the arched pillars, Ap Madoc dismounted and tethered his horse. He stood waiting. Blackstone looked around again. There was still no sign of men in hiding. The forest was as it should be. The birds flew, the breeze ruffled the treetops. He dismounted, walked the bastard horse closer, and then tied his rein off on a secure tree. The Welshman watched him approach, and then sat on a boulder and pulled off his helmet.
"Thomas, I bear you no ill will, whereas you wish to see me dead.
You hanged one of my archers, and tried to kill my sentinel, who nearly died trying to save him.
Ah, Thomas, you know in your heart it wasn't me. What purpose would I have to do such a thing? I had your gold coin, I had two hostages. All I did was make sure you didn't come after me in a hurry. It was William Cade and his men who strung up the lad and attacked your archer. You didn't stop him. I knew nothing of it until it was too late. And now you hound me, running me down like a beast of prey. You know I'll not allow it. We'll fight, and one of us will die, and it won't be me. I don't want to kill you, Thomas, I swear it."
Blackstone tossed the Celtic charm to him. "She won't save you." Ap Madoc caught it, kissed the figure of Arianhod, and put the cord around his neck.
"Knew that would tell you who sent it," he said.
He drank from a flask, and then offered it. Blackstone made no response.
"It's good brandy. We took it from, I forget, someone we butchered along the way."
He swallowed again, and then corked the flask.
"We could fight it out here and now, Thomas, but your gold is with my men, so you would die a poor man. On this place here," he waved a hand at their surroundings, "is no battlefield. No place of glory. Not the place for a legend to die, face down in a muddy stream, beneath some relic of a monument from another time.
Perhaps I care less about the gold, and more about avenging a boy archer.
Oh, for God's sake, man! The lad died at the end of a rope, at the hand of others. Leave it be. No beardless boy is worth us drawing blood, even if I had done it. I told you, William Cade is dead.
I killed him,"
Blackstone interrupted. "He was in the pay of the French king and his scheming son. They have failed to kill me again." The Welshman seemed momentarily surprised that Cade had been tracked down.
"Ah, well, then, your bloodlust should be satisfied with that. I hope the wretch died badly."
"We fought together in the past, Griffith.
You, me, and Gilbert.
We served our king, and now a tide of killing has swept across France and forced us apart. We each went our own way, no longer brothers in arms. We cannot have regret for what could have been.
I am sincere in my wish not to see us fight, Thomas. I swear that."
He kissed the silver-wheeled goddess again.
"She protects us both. But if we go at each other like crazed dogs, all it proves is that you want your money back. Did you take Kate's share?"
"Let's finish this now," said Blackstone. "Once you're dead, I'll follow your men and get back the gold."
Griffith Ap Madoc sighed and stood. He pulled on his helmet.
"Thomas, I will trade you."
"For what? The money?"
"No. Your life or mine. Perhaps you will kill me. Perhaps I you. I think it better if we both live."
"Beyond the gold, there's nothing I want from you, except to close the account of a young archer's death. You gave your word, and he died without priest or mercy."
The Welshman walked slowly towards Blackstone. He stopped at arm's length, too close for either man to draw a weapon.
"Have you heard from Lord de Grey's men? The Gascon Captain Bayard?"
Blackstone's heart skipped a beat.
"No, I thought not."
Ap Madoc stepped away.
"Thomas, I was down near Avignon when your Gascon went among the routiers. He has a persuasive tongue. He convinced enough of them that your promises were as good as gold."
He grinned.
"Me? I believed him as well, though I can't see you granting me the seneschalship of anywhere other than hell."
"If you have harmed him, Griffith, then my revenge will be doubled."
The Welshman rolled his eyes and trembled his hands.
"See? It's terrified I am."
He guffawed.
"I never met him. Christ, Thomas, it's not for me to kill a Gascon like him. Look to the French for that."
"He's dead?"
"Soon will be."
"He's prisoner?"
Ap Madoc snorted and spat.
"Is his life worth trading for mine?"
"You talk too much."
"I'm a Welshman. We love to talk. And fight."
He grinned once more.
"Thomas, it is our language that is the bedrock of your mother tongue. We savour it like a good wine."
He paused, but when he spoke again, his words still tumbled lightly.
"He's not my prisoner, no, but he is imprisoned, for want of a better word. Now, would you trade him for my life?"
"I would not."
"I thought not," said Ap Madoc.
"No, indeed, I thought you would not. So I asked myself, what would Thomas Blackstone trade to let the matter between us rest, and I thought, I know, something more precious than a sack of gold, greater than a loyal man-at-arms. Now, what do you think that might be, eh? Shall I give you a clue? A scholar, brave as a boar facing a hunter, and as sharp and bright as that wolf's sword that you'd love to use on me."
He stopped, eyebrows raised, watching Blackstone's reaction. Blackstone's mind raced to the obvious conclusion.
"Aye, you've got it, then. Aye, Thomas, your lad was being escorted from Florence. I don't know why. A priest and a knight of the Tau with him. They sought sanctuary at Avignon. They heard of your Gascon and made themselves known to him. I don't know the details, but perhaps he offered to bring them on to you."
"Where are they?"
Griffith Ap Madoc pulled his fingers down his beard, studying the renowned knight he had momentarily reduced to a concerned father.
"See, it is over between us, Thomas, and I will tell you where they are, and I will even fight at your side to help release him. I have more men with me now than I had before. I know where the brigands ride, and I know their captains. Routiers are being hunted by the French, who are everywhere. Together with you leading them,
you could finish off these bastard Frenchmen once and for all.
Blackstone took a pace back. Wolf's sword was suddenly in his hand. Griffith ap Madoc smiled and extended his hands away from his own weapons.
"What good would that do?" he said.
He spun around, following Blackstone's gaze, and realized that Blackstone had drawn his sword because of the horsemen who had appeared in the distance, beyond the aqueduct behind him. Routiers or Frenchmen? It made no difference. The two men stood no chance. They ran for their mounts. The Welshman spurred his horse, yanked the reins, and held the panicked beast as he called out to Blackstone.
"Brignay! It's held by mercenaries. They are trapped behind the town's walls by a French army. You are in my debt, Thomas. Do not forget it."
And then he galloped across the valley. Blackstone turned the bastard horse to where his men were encamped. He would lose the approaching horsemen in the depths of the forest, but knew he could not afford to lose time in reaching his son. The remaining corner of his heart, capable of love, was besieged with fear. Chapter 63 The woodcutter repaid his debt to Blackstone. Despite his skinny frame, he ran tirelessly through the vast forest, outpacing the horses that followed him. Before the midday sun rose above the treetops on the second day, he slowed and gestured to Blackstone, indicating the moss-covered boulders that tumbled into a wood-strewn gully. At first, Blackstone could not see what the wiry man was pointing at. His toothless grin seemed to imply he had a secret, and he scrambled sure-footed down the awkward slope, pushing himself through waist-high ferns.
"God's tears, Thomas! I hope he doesn't expect us to ride down there. I thought he was going to show us a way out of this forest and avoid the French," said Cubert, as he watched the woodcutter reach the bottom of the gully.
"He will," said Blackstone. "There's something down there he wants to show us."
The woodcutter began to pull aside undergrowth, and then called for Blackstone to go down to him. Blackstone handed his reins to John Jacob and clambered after the man. It was treacherous going, but he persevered, for as he pushed through the ferns, he saw debris from a broken wagon wheel and what looked to be scattered remnants of planking that would have served as part of a cart's baseboard. When he reached the woodcutter, he saw what he had exposed. There were four barrels, some cracked open, but mostly intact. The man grinned and nodded his head excitedly.
"For you, my lord, for you."
The man took a small chopping axe from his belt and hacked away one of the barrel lids. Blackstone bent down and reached inside, and felt the familiar soft touch of goose feather in the palm of his hand. He closed his grip and pulled out a handful of arrows.
"Soldiers came this way months ago, and their wagon fell, my lord. We hid these barrels because we were afraid and did not know who to trust. We wanted no trouble. We buried the wagoner's bodies."
Blackstone grinned and placed a hand on the man's shoulder in gratitude. He looked up to where the mounted men stared down at him, and he raised his fist, clutching the yard-long arrows.
"Will, Jack, Quesnel, down here."
Will Longdon and his archers would rather starve than have their arrow bags empty, and, now that they had bundles bound and tied to a pack horse, like hungry men at a feast, their spirits lifted. Every man would have at least four sheaves, and from what Blackstone had told them about the French army attacking the town where his son had sought sanctuary, they would need them. When the arrows were secured, the woodcutter ran on like a tireless dog ahead of the horsemen, until on the fourth day of travel from the mountains and forests of La Roche, they reached a clearing close to where the sky stretched beyond the confines of the trees. The clearing exposed tracks etched across the rolling countryside. Smoke rose from distant hamlets, and sunlight caught a slithering, narrow river that twisted towards dark smudges in the distance that could be more woodland or perhaps further villages. Once Blackstone's eyes adjusted to the distances, the multitude of bare, feathered sticks that clung to hillsides were revealed as stakes, holding rows of vines like silent, stationary soldiers. The forest dweller spat phlegm and let his eyes gaze across the vast expanse that was denied him in his day-to-day existence. Then he clambered on top of a boulder and pointed to one side.
5 leagues, said the woodcutter.
He turned and looked at Blackstone, but there was no smile on his face this time.
Brig Ney, my lord.
Blackstone eased his horse alongside their guide. Beyond the landmarks, the ground flattened into a plain, and Blackstone saw a speckled mass of movement that his eyes soon told him was a barely moving mass of encamped men. It was the French army, under Jean de Tancarville's command, and they numbered in their thousands. From his vantage point, Blackstone spied out the best route to take them behind the French army. To reach his son behind the walls of Brignais seemed an impossible task. The town was built on high ground, and the French would need time to defeat its defenders. He saw a low stone bridge across a narrow river that would funnel the troops, and knew, if it could be blocked or enough of the enemy killed on it, that might slow the French attack sufficiently for him to find a way inside. "There could be danger behind us, Thomas," said Gilbert, as they slowed their horses, approaching within 1,000 yards of the rear of the French, using irrigation channels as cover from any sentries patrolling the perimeter. The watercourse was shallow, the ground yielding to mud beneath the horses' hooves. Blackstone looked back. Gilbert was correct. If French reinforcements arrived across the undulating land behind them, Blackstone and his few men would be trapped between the two forces. "Don't worry, Gilbert. By the time any more French arrive, we'll most likely be dead." "Ah, always pleased to hear that you have a plan," said Gilbert. He grinned, but there was a look of resignation at the impossible task that lay ahead. "When the time comes, Thomas, we must retreat up there, those of us alive." Gilbert pointed to where one of the fields on their flank rose up. The spring vines were still bare, but they would offer good defence once the men were obliged to retreat. They could hold a first wave of attack from there, but it would not take long for the heavy horse to trample them and the vines into the ground. Desperation would make them sell their lives dearly, and it seemed to Blackstone that their only hope would be to join Henry and the town knight behind the walls. A roar rose up from the French army. Blackstone dismounted and crawled to the top of the water channel's lip. The French had thrown another attack against the walls. It would soon be dark, and Blackstone could barely make out the assault, but the narrow bridge did indeed slow the French as they swarmed forward. The defenders were hurling rocks and stones down on those below their walls. Scaling ladders were being pushed away, and the French were dying. Yet sooner or later the overwhelming numbers of attackers would prevail. The defenders would not be able to kill enough French, and those left would clamber over their own dead to reach those inside. Gilbert, Moulin, and John Jacob joined Blackstone on the wet ground and peered across the ditch's wall, each of them gauging the strengths and weaknesses of the attacking force. Moulin glanced at his comrades in puzzlement and then gazed back at the French ranks.
"Lucarde! Do you see what I see?"
The men kept looking. What had Moulin spotted, and they had not?
"There's another drainage ditch a few 100 yards behind them, which would get us closer if we could reach it unseen," said John Jacob.
"He's right," said Gilbert. "Over there, on the left, you can see where this ditch leads into it. We could get close enough to count the hairs on the back of their necks, but there are so few of us against so many of them. Still, it's close to that bridge and the town gate. Perhaps we could move through them at night."
Blackstone glanced across at Moulin, who smiled.
"There's more than that," said Blackstone. "What have you seen?"
Moulin raised his eyes across the parapet again and waggled his finger back and forth.
"They have no rear pickets. There are no sentries, no rear defences. Everything they do is focused on the town."
For a brief, incredulous moment, the other three men looked again.
"Arrogant bastards think they're too many to worry about a rear attack," said John Jacob.
"And we are too few to take them on. But if we had Felton and Louis de Harcourt with us, we could make them bleed," said Gilbert.
Blackstone remained silent.
his mind racing to find a way through the blind spots and reach the gates. There were thousands of infantry and crossbowmen, and at least a third of the force would be knights and men-at-arms on horseback. Even if they got halfway under cover of darkness, a troop of men riding at the walk unhurried, as if they belonged with the French. Could such a daring plan be successful? One challenge, and they would be overwhelmed.
"What banners do we see?" said Blackstone. "Men of Lorraine."
"And there's Jacques de Bourbon's," said John Jacob. He winced. De Bourbon was a renowned fighter. "Lyonnais, Bourbonnais, the Count of Forez. Christ, there's as many noblemen here as we killed at Poitiers," said Gilbert. Turning his back on the host, he pulled free his helm. Scrubbing his palm over his sweat-streaked hair, he grinned. "Kill a few more of their high and mighty, and King John will have a seizure. We'd save Edward a lot of trouble."
"There are men from Savoy out there as well," said Moulin.
The men slumped down the ditch wall.
"We can get Will and his lads closer tonight, Thomas," said Gilbert. "We need to see if there's a gap in the French ranks tomorrow, or whether there's another route we haven't seen."
Blackstone nodded in agreement. The water channel was wide enough for a dozen men to gather across. He summoned his men.
"There are too few of us to cause these thousands any harm, but they have no defence in their rear. Tonight we will walk the horses through these ditches. We cannot be seen, and then we will wait until dawn to see what can be done. If Will and his archers take up position on the rear of the ditch, then any attack can be repulsed. French horses will die here and their riders with them. But once arrows are loosed, it's only a matter of time before foot soldiers come swarming. Then Will and Sir Gilbert will form a defensive line beyond those vines."
He looked at the grim faces that stared back at him. "I will not ask you to strike through their ranks with me. Too many of us will die. If the diversion is enough, and we cause chaos among them, then I will get through and reach my son."
"And I," said John Jacob.
"Me too," said Moulin. "I know young Henry, and wish to see him safe."
"And Bayard owes me money," said Renfred. "So best I come with you, Sir Thomas."
"And I have no wish to sit here with my arse in freezing water," said Perrine.
"The more of us at your side, the better."
A murmur of agreement rippled through the men.
"We'll have no damn disagreement here," growled Kilbert. "If Will and Jack and Quesnel and their lads do their killing, and then ride free of their infantry when they turn on them, then we all go. Bayard will need help in there, and I'll wager there's fewer than 200 manning those walls."
He looked at Blackstone.
"We are in agreement, Thomas. We have fought too hard together over the years."
He looked at the grinning faces.
"None here will see you strike out alone."
He stepped to his horse and took its reins.
"Besides, you and that bastard horse of yours would probably get lost without us, and you would end up in a cage and carted off to Paris. Then where would your lad be?"
"And there I was, thinking we could all end up in Italy with good wine and plump women." He sighed. "We will have to forsake those pleasures for another time."
"You see how obvious it is, damn it. You need us."
Chapter 64 Bayard was bloodied. He had grappled with a determined Frenchman, one of the hundreds who had clambered onto the walls, and taken a blow to the head. Blood trickled into his eyes until the scalp wound caked dry. His men fought hand to hand, beating skulls with rocks, slashing and stabbing with any weapon to hand. And once again they had pushed away the scaling ladders. The few defenders of the castle at Brignais had fought on every wall, and their numbers were dwindling. As darkness began to seep across the landscape, he and his men counted their losses. Fra Foresti had joined the routiers on one of the walls after extracting a promise from Henry Blackstone that he would stay clear of the fighting and help servants carry water buckets to those who fought. Water had soon given way to gathering and carrying rocks to hurl down. Henry had helped break down a low stone wall, and, like a beast of burden, carried a yoke across his shoulders bearing rubble. Young men and children scurried here and there, responding to cries from the men on the walls. Exhaustion was claiming them all. and they knew it was only a matter of time before the sheer weight of French numbers swarmed over the walls, and then a final stand would be made in the small castle. As the daylight faded, so too did the last attack of the day. When they had arrived at Brignais, it had turned out that Bayard outranked everyone in the garrison, and its defence had fallen to him. He had reached the hilltop town with little time to spare. His 150 Gascons, along with Henry Blackstone and Fra Foresti, were too small a force to challenge the hordes of French who swept down the Rhone Valley, to destroy the routiers riding north, intending to invade the Duchy of Burgundy. Bayard's party had been caught in the middle. When they had retreated into the mountain foothills, they had joined forces with a small band of routiers, who told him of a mercenary stronghold held by a few men at Brignais. It could not have been a more unfortunate place of refuge. The French army, already pressing south of Lyon, had descended, seeking a routier by the name of Helie Mechin, another Gascon, who had once served the French, and had become a brigand when released from their service. He was nothing more than a gangster who occupied towns and villages, and the routiers quickly learned that the French had decided to trap and kill him. That he had slipped their net and taken to the hills was ignored, if it was ever known, because the rumour was that Blackstone himself was behind the walls. Bayard shouted his orders. "We need lances cut down and sharpened. 3 men on every lance." Weary men nodded their understanding and began to gather their weapons ready for another assault, whenever it might come. "Fra Foresti," Bayard called to the town knight, who was helping to carry a wounded man down from the walls. The hospitaller handed responsibility to another and joined the Gascon captain in the yard. "They will breach us tomorrow," said Bayard. "We cannot hold the walls. What shall we do about Henry? We cannot escape through the French lines. If I and my men stay, do you think the French would honour a knight of the Tau and a pilgrim in his charge?"
"Possibly, but it's a great risk."
"No greater than staying here," said Bayard. "You can tell them that you were captured and held by us." Fra Foresti fell silent. Bayard put a reassuring hand on his shoulder.
"We have to get Henry out. Once the French break through, they'll kill every soul here, man and boy. We could not even disguise him as a servant. This place will be burnt to the ground, and all of us with it."
"Have you thought why they have committed their army to destroy this insignificant place?
It's held by so few. What a threat does Brignais offer?"
Bayard shook his head.
"We don't need to know why. They are scraping the land clear of routiers. We are in the wrong place, and I am sorry for bringing us here."
"You know there was an attempt on the boy's life. He is worth more than gold to those who seek to hurt his father."
"You think all of this is because of him?" said Bayard.
"Thousands of men to seize a boy?"
He stared at the injured being carried away, and the dead being laid out in the dirt of the yard.
"No, that cannot be."
"Someone tried to kill him, Bayard. Perhaps their intention is not to seize him."
Bayard sighed.
"Merciful Christ! If they killed him, then Sir Thomas would set this world on fire, and he would be hunted down by every prince and nobleman. Every beggar and assassin would have just cause to kill him."
Fra Foresti looked to where Henry was helping to tend the wounded.
"We are not to know what reason lies behind this. All we can do is stand our ground. In his last breath, the boy must declare who he is, and then his name will either save or condemn him. Capture or death, that is all that remains."
Blackstone and his men led their horses along the deep channel. At its end, it turned into another drainage course. The evening breeze was in their faces, so the smell of men and animals reached their nostrils. Being downwind gave Blackstone's men the advantage, and as they peered over the top of the high ditch wall, they heard voices of the French troops settled about their thousand fires.
"They're damned fools. Look at them. We could walk among them and cut their throats. No sentries, not one," said Kilbert quietly. "Damn, they're so close now, I could spit on them."
The rear ranks of the French army lay 150-yard-long strides from where the men hid.
"The French commanders have no need to fear anyone," said Moulin, "not with so many. Who is there to strike at them? No one in any strength."
Blackstone studied the scattered troops. "We'll place Will and his lads behind this ditch. They'll kill enough to get their attention, and then we ride through. The French have a well-trodden path towards the walls. They funnel themselves across the field. We'll ride in on that. I wish we could have got you closer, Will. Killing them on the bridge would have slowed their advance, but we will have you strike them once you see us attacked. Until that moment, I and the others will ride hard and fast. It might get us close." Will Longdon lay flat on his belly, like the other men at his side. "Come the morning, I'll have Jack and Quesnel take their men back 50 paces behind us. They can shoot first. The range will be good to kill the French at the back. And when Jack brings his lads forward, mine will already be shooting deeper into the French ranks. We'll kill them in waves, just like the old days," he said, grinning. "As we try to reach that bridge, they'll turn on you, Will. We'll have a fight on our hands, but you won't have time to get the horses free from here, and that vineyard is 350 yards, said Blackstone. "You'll be running for your life." "Thomas, when any of them come at us, they'll be stumbling over their own dead. Then they have to get across this ditch, with us on the other side, and the horses below them. We can buy enough time for you and the others to gallop through, and with a few thousand Frenchmen chasing us, we'll get to that vineyard quicker than any arrow falls from the sky." Blackstone turned and looked along the huddled men and horses who waited silently in the darkness. Once again he had given every man the opportunity to leave, and once again they had ignored his pleas that many of them would die while trying to reach the gates. His son would have every chance to live, but so many of Blackstone's men would die in the attempt. The odds were too large. For a moment he considered abandoning his son, because trying to reach him would see the death of so many of the men he held dear. The sacrifice was too great. Kildare was the closest man to him, and despite the darkness, he must have seen the doubt crease Blackstone's features. The veteran knight whispered, "It's all right, Thomas. They'll die for you tomorrow, as they would any other day." Chapter 65 The men slept as best they could, each tying their mount's rein to leg or arm. Horses relieved themselves, shifted their weight, and half-slept. Like their riders who lay in their animals' filth, curled in on themselves on the wet ground, giving no thought to the following day or their fetid conditions. A man's stench meant nothing when he was soon to be covered in gore. As the pre-dawn light crept across the sky, they roused themselves, stiff from the wet ground. They rubbed warmth back into their muscles. Some scooped shallow water from the bottom of the ditch and freshened their faces. Blackstone gripped Will Longdon's arm and embraced the man who, like Kildare, had been at his side since the first day he had gone to war. No words were needed, as the veteran archer clambered up the rear of the ditch wall, keeping his men low against the skyline as they crawled into position. The French army slowly awoke, their fires wafting the tantalizing smell of cooking over Blackstone's men. But it would not be the first time he and his men had gone into battle hungry. They fussed their horses, pressing their palms against their soft noses, giving them their familiar scent. Girth straps were tightened. Some knelt briefly in prayer. Others spat the night's foulness from their throats. Most relieved their bladders. They had all been told what was expected the moment Thomas Blackstone mounted that bastard horse of his. God willing, the beast would trample its way through the French ranks, some muttered quietly among themselves. The barely lit day showed their grinning faces. Best to be at the French while they scratched their balls and yawned themselves into wakefulness. Blackstone would lead his men to the end of the ditch, where its grassy walls were low enough to spur their horses up and into the unsuspecting French. Then it was a race to the gates, shields high, so that their enemies and their friends could see who it was who rode towards Brignais. Perrine saw the shadow high in the sky. "She's hunting early for men's souls," said Will Longdon, resignedly, and then placed a hand on his friend's shoulder. "We must watch out for Thomas.
Once they see him, they will want him dead.
Kilbert undid one of his saddlebags and stepped towards Blackstone. He carried a folded banner. Catching Moulin's eye, he beckoned the Norman captain to him.
Your spear?